I want to talk about lattice reduction. So first of all, why talking about lattice reduction? First of all, I think it's a nice problem, but that's a totally subjective opinion. Another reason is that it has a lot of applications, which I'm not going to describe at all today. There are two talks related to application of lattices on Friday. So for those who do not know, there's a lot of application in algorithmic number theory, factorization, Dirac-Fitting approximations, linear dependencies, a lot of application in theoretical computer science, integer programming. There's a lot of interest in complexity theory right now, in the standard model, but also in the quantum complexity classes, because it's one of the few potentially hard problems with respect to quantum computers. And of course, there's a lot of application in cryptology, both in cryptanalysis, because lattice reduction is the main tool to attack public key crypto systems, but also in crypto design. Now we have several alternative crypto systems based on the hardness of lattice problems. But today I won't talk at all about application. I just want to talk about the algorithms themselves. So I have a few slides to introduce where lattices come from. And then what I want to do today is I want to describe essentially all the lattice reduction algorithms we know, but I want to describe them a bit differently than one you can find in the literature, usually in textbooks. So what I want to highlight is a connection between these algorithms and a well-known mathematical problem related to the so-called Hermite's constant. And what is surprising is that all the algorithms we know are related to these constants. So usually when you see the description of the algorithm, it kind of ignores the mathematical analog. And probably when you read the mathematical literature, it ignores the algorithms. But there's a very tight relationship between those two, which I think is interesting to try to speculate about future algorithms. Okay, so that's what I want to do. So for those who do not know, the history starts with the following problem. Suppose you have euro coins, and you want to know what's the optimal way of pack those euro coins. That means I don't want any overlap on those coins, and I want the minimal empty space. So of course, if you're very Cartesian, you find this diagram. But if you're a bit smarter and you realize that this is better packing. So this is known as the hexagonal packing, and it's not hard to prove that this is actually the optimal way of packing euro coins on a plane. And you see the hexagon, which is hidden here. A natural problem is what happens in higher dimensions. So there's a well-known problem that asks the same problem in dimension three, what is the best way of packing the ranges in the space? And you have no restriction on the spheres. You just assume that they are all the same, and you don't want any overlap. So Kepler conjectured in the 17th century that this was actually the optimal packing, so the one we see in markets when you buy ranges. And it's a very difficult problem. And the first complete proof was announced a few years ago, and it was published only last year. So Hale showed, using a lot of numerical computation, that this is actually the optimal packing in dimension three. And for higher dimensions, we don't know. So if you want to generalize this problem, of course, you ask, what is the best sphere packing in higher dimension? But we saw that already in dimension three, it took a long, long time to solve it. So people have been uncertain in trying to tackle an easier problem. What if we restrict the packings to special classes of packings, such as lattice packings, when the centers of the sphere form some regular patterns? And if we come back to the previous problem in dimension 2 and dimension 3, you see that this packing is actually lattice packing. The center of the euro coins form a lattices. And the same happens for this packing in dimension 3. So in dimension 2 and in dimension 3, it turns out that the best packings are lattice packings. But in general, it's not conjectured to be true. But this motivated the study of lattices, trying to find at least the best lattice packings. Maybe this is easier. So that's one way of trying to introduce lattices. Another way comes from Euclid's algorithm. And this is much more related to lattice reduction. So I don't want to insult you by presenting that algorithm, but it's quite cool to see it again. So you have two integers, and you want to add the GCD, and the well-known algorithm does this. So according to, I think, Knuth, this is the oldest non-trivial algorithm. we say about it? Well, there's a lot of generalization of Euclid's algorithm, but the interesting one is the one in the 18th century, and at least for this talk. So there's a paper by Lagrange in the 18th century, which is written in French, and for those who are interested in this topic, I really recommend the reading of that paper. So the introduction starts as follows. Lagrange notices that Euclid's algorithm allows you to answer the following question. If I give you three numbers, A and B, and I want to answer the following question, is the number n of the form ax plus by, where x and y are integers? So of course this is easy to do using Euclid's algorithm. And then he asks, what happens if we make the problem a little bit more complex? Say, I had one more numbers, and I want to know whether n is of the form ax squared plus bxy plus cy squared, where x and y are integers. So that's what we call the two-dimensional generalization of Euclid's algorithm. So for us, the way you see it is that if you look at Euclid's algorithm, you can say that, okay, it computes the GCD, but also another way to see it is to say that Euclid's algorithm actually computes the shortest non-zero linear combination of the numbers A and B. And then you have an obvious generalization. So of course I replace my numbers A and B by vectors with integer coordinates. Can one compute the shortest non-zero vector, the Euclidean norm, the set of all the linear combinations of those vectors? So it's a natural translation of Euclid's problem. So Lagrange actually solved this problem in dimension 2 for n equal to 2. Because now I want to say a few things about Bergmann analysis, which I will need. So I will take R to the n as Euclidean space, and this is my notation for the dot products and for the norm. So for me here, so there's a lot of different definitions of lattices. It doesn't really matter which definition you take. But in this talk, the one I'm going to take is a discrete subgroup of R to the n. So the canonical example is Zn and all their subgroups. And these are actually the one we deal in practice. In practice, we don't deal with other lattices. We always come back to that particular case of integral lattices.
So you don't assume it's maxwell, right?
Yeah, I don't assume, because it's not very convenient for what I'm going to do. But it really doesn't matter. So it's well known that there's an equivalence between the two properties. Ever you take a discrete subgroup of R to the n, ever you consider a set of linearly independent vectors, and the lattice is just a set of all the linear combinations with integral coefficients of those vectors. And whenever you have a set like this, you call this set a basis, and the number of elements in such a basis, we call it dimension or the rank of the lattice. So that's well known. So there's something called, what people call the volume, some other people call it the determinant, some other people call it the covolume. Perhaps if you're really rigorous, the covolume is the best denotation, but here I want to use the volume. So what is the volume? Each basis spans a parallel of hypots. You have plenty of bases, but they all have the same volume, which only depends on the lattice. So that's what I call the lattice volume. Why is it called a covolume too? Well, you just take the linear span of the lattice, you quotient it with the lattice, and you get the torus, and that's also the volume of this torus. So it's also called determinant. So historically, actually, lattices were not used directly. They were used in terms of quadratic forms. So Lagrange algorithm actually deals with quadratic forms, but it's really the same thing. Whenever you have a lattice basis, you induce a positive definite quadratic form as follows. You just take, so imagine your basis is b1, b2, bd, and when you consider the quadratic form defined as follows, u of x1 xd is equal to this, and then you have this. And reciprocally, if you start with a positive definite quadratic form, you can define a lattice basis with real coefficients which correspond to quadratic form. So you can do it, for instance, using Chorlosky factorizations. So it's really the same thing. Thinking about lattices or thinking about positive definite quadratic forms, it doesn't really matter. And in fact, all the algorithms we know for lattice reduction, they actually deal with the quadratic form. They don't really use a representation. So then you have a lot of correspondence, for instance. So if you take the square volume of your lattice, and it's actually a discriminant of the form, and it's really the form which determines the geometry of your lattice. So what else do I need to name some of the notations? So because the lattice is discrete, it's not difficult to prove, and also because it's a group, that if you intersect any bounded set with a lattice, you get a finite set. So as a result, you can define for any integer k between 1 and the dimension of the lattice, you can consider the smallest ball centered at 0, which contains k linearly independent lattice vectors. So that you denote it as lambda k. So for instance, lambda 1 is the first minimum, the shortest vector. Lambda 2 is the length of the second to shortest vector. That is the shortest vector which is not, which is linearly independent from the first vector, and so on. So that was defined by Minkowski in the 19th century. So what is interesting is that Hermite was the first to notice in the 19th century that there's something strange. If you divide the first minimum by the diff root of the volume, you can bound this independently of the lattice, only depending on the dimension. So that's why we call it the Hermite constant. So it's the maximum over all d-dimensional lattices of this quantity. And we know that this quantity is rich. For any dimension, there is a lattice which exactly reaches this value. And we have a good estimate on this constant. We know that it's at most linear, but it's also lower bounded by a linear function of the dimension. So we know that it's linear, essentially linear in the dimension. And the way Hermite did it is that he did it by generalizing Lagrange algorithms. It's actually the ancestor of the famous LLL algorithm. But I'll get back to that point. The exact value of this constant is actually known only for very few dimensions, up to dimension 8 and dimension 24. So that was a breakthrough result 2 years ago. These are all the values of Hermite constant that we know. If you look at this table, you can notice that all the values increases. It's even an open problem to know whether Hermite constant increases or not. So finding Hermite constant is the same thing as asking what is the best lattice packing for the same dimensions. So what are these colors? It's about the techniques which were used in mathematics to prove to find the exact value of Hermite's constant. So up to dimension 4, you can use reduction techniques. And after that, there's a problem. So people invent a new technique to tackle dimension 5 to 8. Essentially, from 5 to 8, what you do is you find some criteria that must be satisfied by all lattices which could reach this. So you have a set of candidates for all the lattices which are critical. And after that, you exhaustive search all of them. You compute the value for this, and you find out which one is the best. So that's how you find Hermite constant up to dimension 8. Dimension 24 is pretty different, and it only works for this dimension 8 and 2. It's very, very nice work, but I'm not going to talk about it at all. So it was done by Korn and Kumar 2 years ago. So the important thing is this. You may wonder, why is there a square in that definition? The only reason is because of historical reason, because we deal with quadratic forms historically, and that's why we have a square. Otherwise, we would take just lambda 1 divided by diff root of the volume. We could also ask, it's the same as asking, what is the max of lambda 1 of L square for all L such that the volume is equal to 1. By scale, you can always bring back to that case. It's another way of saying it. Okay, now enough about notation. Now I want to know more about algorithmic problems. So whenever you have a basis, whenever you have a lattice, it's usually given to you through a basis. So what is a basis in practice? It's just a matrix. So what are the parameters which are in the matrix? You have ever the size of the coefficients of the matrix. And you also have the dimensions of the matrix. So usually there are two cases in the literature. The first case is when the dimension is fixed and only the size of the coefficients of the matrix increases. So So that's one interesting case. The more interesting case is this one. You assume that the dimension increases and the size of the coefficients remains polynomial in the dimension. So the hardness of Lattice problems starts with the second case, not for the first. In fixed dimension, essentially all problems are easy. So what is hard is when the dimension increases. So there's a lot of lattice problems. The main one, the most famous one, is the Shor's vector problem. The problem is very natural. I give you a basis of the lattice, and I want to find a lattice vector that reaches the first minimum. So finding the Shor's vector of the lattice. This problem is now known to be NP-hard under randomized induction. So as a result, we don't really expect to find an efficient algorithm to solve this problem in all cases. So we may wonder what happens if we make the problem easier, what happens if we relax the problem. So there's several ways of relaxing the problem. The most popular one is the approximate Shor's vector problem as follows. You just ask for a non-zero vector such that the norm is said not too far away by some function of the dimension. The problem with that is that often when you have a lattice, you don't know beforehand what is exactly the value of lambda 1. So you don't really know how good this is. You can have, of course, you can approximate it, but you may not know exactly what is this value. So sometimes this is actually more interesting in practice. You ask just for finding a non-zero vector in the lattice such that the norm is less than this by some functions. So there's actually a relationship between all these problems. So of course, using the bounds on Hermite constants, if you can solve this problem, you can also solve this problem with a slightly different f of d. And reciprocally, Lovaas showed in the 80s that if you can solve this problem, you can solve this problem, but you lose a square. F of d becomes square here. But what's interesting is that for the main lattice reduction algorithms, we actually solve both problems together. We can find this and can also find this without using the relationship between lambda 1 and this. So at least the good thing with this is that you can really check the performances of your algorithm easily here. There's no ambiguity. Here there's always an ambiguity. How good is lambda 1? It really depends on your lattices. Sometimes you don't know lambda 1 beforehand, so that's a problem. Okay, so now I've defined enough notation, I can talk about the algorithm. So what I want is now to talk about the problem of bounding Hermite's constant and to see what is the algorithmic analog of this. So here's one of the first strategies to find Hermite's constants. So that was used up to dimension 4 in history. What you do is you try to find a good upper bound first, and then you show that upper bound is actually a lower bound by exhibiting an appropriate lattice. And actually, by your construction, you kind of guess what is the good lattice. So this actually works up to dimension 4 included, but it doesn't work after. So how do you bound Hermite's constant? Well, essentially, if we think about an algorithm which only approximates the shortest vector problem, I only know two provable ones. One is the LL algorithm, and the other one is Schnorr algorithms. And what is funny is that the LL algorithm is exactly the algorithmic analog of something known as Hermite's inequality on Hermite's constants. And Schnorr algorithm more or less corresponds to something known as Model's inequality. So it's not exactly the same, but you will see exactly what I mean by that. That's what I want to tell more about. So to know about the inequality, I need one last notation about Gram-Schmidt, and you will see why we need Gram-Schmidt. So if you remember linear algebra, if you start with a free family, if you start with d linearly independent vectors, the way you build an orthonormal basis is that you construct d pairwise orthogonal vectors such that the I vector is actually just a projection of the I vector of the orthogonal complement of the previous vectors. So if I start with 1, 2, 3 vectors, the first one is the same, the second one I project it and I get this vector, and the third one I project it and I get this vector. this Gramscian family, we call it the VI star. There's a standard notation in the field, which is mu ij of those coefficients. So what is important is just this formula, this one. So that's a bit of a hassle. In all lattice reduction papers, people have to use those notation. So why do we care about Gramschmidt? Actually, you can even forget about these formulas. The only thing that matters is just a way to represent a lattice better. I mean, if you think about matrices, the simplest one of the simplest matrices are just triangular matrices. So the good thing about Gramschmidt is that it enables you to view any lattice basis as a triangular matrix if you change a representation. So if you change of your canonical basis, using a natural phonemic basis based on Gramschmidt, you realize that the matrix of your lattice basis just become triangular. And the shape of your matrix is the following. On the diagonal, you get all the norm of the VI star. And here you have the mu ij which intervenes. So the lattice here is just all the integral linear combination of those rows. So this notation is just a good way to view the lattice to make operations on it. So for instance, if you view the lattice this way, you realize that it's easy. If you want to make all these coefficients small, one obvious way is to make all these mu ij coefficients less than 1 over 2. It's obvious because if I take this row, for instance, I can subtract the first row. So I can always subtract the multiple of b1 star here. So I can always make this less than 1 over 2 in absolute value. And you can do the same for the first column. The same you can do for here. So easily you can make all these anti-diagonal coefficients, all the mu ij, you can make them less than 1 over 2 if you do it the right way. So all that remains to make those vectors small is to find something on the diagonal coefficients. The anti-diagonal are easy to tackle. What is hard is what to do with these guys. So Gramscian, every time we deal with Gramscian, it's just a way of seeing basis in a triangular is a triangular matrix. So for instance, the volume is just, because it's the determinant of this matrix, it's just a product of the diagonal coefficients. And then you realize that as a result, if the Gramschmidt, if this BI star, the norm of the BI star did not decrease too fast, then B1 won't be too far from the D-foot of the volume. Because the D-foot of the volume is just the geometric mean of the BI star. And similarly, you would also, so this gives you the Hermite bound. So when you wanted to solve the problem, which is find a vector which is not too far away from the d-root of the volume. So that's it. I mean, if I have this, this will be true. There's no more entry now. And never from the first minimum because of this inequality, which is not hard to prove. So lambda 1 is actually always larger than the minimum of the BI star, of the diagonal coefficients. OK, so now we want to see what's the relationship between bounding Hermite's constant and the algorithms we know for approximating the shortest vector problem. So let's start with the easiest case, the two-dimensional case. So I'm sure you have seen this figure before. So what happens in dimension 2, it's very easy. If you have two vectors and basis, so let's assume that this is your first vector. And now I give you the second basis vector. So whatever it is, by subtracting a multiple of your first vector, it's always possible to move back your vectors in this area here, right? So to make the dot product normalize less than 1 over 2, as I did for my triangular matrix. And once you are here, but two cases, ever you're larger than your vector, then you stop. Ever you're inside the circle, and then you swap your vectors, and you repeat it again. So then it's obvious that at the end, you'll get a set of vectors such that what? Such that the first vector will be here, and the second vector will lie in this area. So what happens? We know that the mu coefficient, the anti-diagonal, is less than 1 over 2. And on this figure, it's clear that this ratio, b1 star squared divided by b2 squared, is less than 4/3. So that actually gives you the bound, the upper bound, gamma 2 less than 4 thirds, 1 over 2. And by construction, you realize that the critical case is this one. So if you take that is, you realize that this is actually inequality. So what is fun is that what we did is that we prove an upper bound on Hermite's constant dimension 2, realize it's actually a lower bound because it is suggested the lattice, which is critical. But we also found an algorithm in the process. I mean, we start with two vectors, and then we did that process, and that's actually an algorithm. So that's actually Lagrange algorithm. So unfortunately, in the literature, it's also known as Gauss algorithm, but they really, if you read Gauss' papers, well, Gauss' book, he does reference Lagrange. And if you read Lagrange's paper in French, then you realize it's really written already in Lagrange's paper. So it's really Lagrange algorithm. Well, the Lagrange was not exactly French, so.
What was Lagrange?
He was Italian, I think. But awkward in these days, I mean, it's hard to define precise frontier, but he was initially Italian. So here, if you want to remember Lagrange algorithm, you just remember this inequality. And once you have this inequality, you can really reconstruct the algorithm. So what happens in higher dimensions? So when Hermit proved the existence of this constant, what he proved first was an upper bound. So what was the upper bound? It was this upper bound. And then you realize that Lagrange algorithm is exactly d equal to 2. So this is really the generalization of the two-dimensional case. How do you prove an inequality? Well, it's very easy. It's a two-line proof. You just take a shortest vector of the lattice, and you consider the projection of your lattice over the hyperplane orthogonal to you. So then you lose one dimension. Then you apply your induction on this new lattice L prime. And by considering a shortest vector u prime of L prime, and you lift it to L in such a way as before in Lagrange algorithm that the component over span of u is small, so that the coefficient is less than 1 over 2, if you plug all the inequalities together, you realize that the induction remains true. So you just prove it by induction. And in fact, if you think about this proof, it's actually also an algorithm. It actually gives you the algorithms. What is this algorithm? It's actually an algorithm which was described in Hermite's paper in 1853, I believe. And this is actually almost the LL algorithm. What is the difference between LL and that algorithm? Well, LL actually works in the dual of that lattice. And because we want LL to be polynomial time, you have to relax a little bit the algorithm. Because this algorithm, which would be deduced from this proof, we do not know whether it's polynomial time. It terminates, but we don't know about the complexity. Nobody knows whether it's polynomial time or not right now. So in some sense, I mean, this is actually the oldest lattice reduction algorithm in arbitrary dimension. Well, there's no, the argument which is used in LL, it doesn't work here because you don't relax anything. Uh-huh. So I'll talk a little bit more right after. So what Hermite did using his algorithm, which he described so in 1853, to improve the existence of bases, because those were built by his algorithm, such that there were two properties. One was the antidiagonal coefficients were less than 1 over 2, if you normalize them. And you have this condition on the diagonal coefficients. So if you remember my big matrix, my triangular matrix, I have one star here. Then I have all these things with the new ij. So the first condition, just saying that, I make all those coefficients below the diagonal not too big, and this second condition just say that the diagonal coefficients not drop too fast. That's all. And then from this condition, it's easy to prove the following. First of all, that The first vector is then not that far from the diff root of the volume. So that's how you get Hermite's inequality or Hermite's constants. And you also get easily that each vector is not too far away from the corresponding minimum. So everything depends on the forward here. So what is really important is the drop of those vectors. So that's just the existence of Bayes' his algorithm. Of course, in the 19th century, nobody was interested in really establishing the complexity of that algorithm. It's just a construction of the mind, just to show the existence of those Bayes. So from a computational point of view, nobody knows how to compute such Bayes in polynomial time. However, Lenstra-Lobach found a really nice trick. That is, if you relax this condition, if you transform 4/3 to 4/3 plus epsilon, then we know a polynomial time algorithm. So that's the famous LLL algorithm. So the only, essentially, the main difference between LLL and Hermite's algorithm is just relaxing this. So that was the first polynomial time algorithm in arbitrary dimension. And so one year ago, we realized that if you also relax this factor here, which is not really too bad, then what is surprising is that you obtain an analog of Euclid's algorithm for lattices, because you obtain a quadratic running time. So whenever you have a lattice reduction algorithms, you have the complexity is measured with respect to the dimension, and say the bit size of the coefficients. So we always have the running time of the form d to the power a, this to the power d. So this essentially is linear algebra, the cost of manipulating all your matrices. And this is the cost of multiplying the coefficients. So in the initial LLL, what happens is that this coefficient was free, which is not compatible with Euclid's algorithm. If you take Euclid's algorithm, which I described before, the running time is quadratic. It's the same running time as the multiplication. Even though you do not use fast multiplication techniques, you have the same cost as the multiplication. So here, what I mean here by the quadratic running time is that you push down this 3 to 2, which is quite surprising. So essentially, if you forget about linear algebra, it's the same running time as the multiplication of your initial coefficients.
What if you do a fast multiplication?
Well, if you do fast multiplication, then you can get, say, something 2 plus epsilon. It's more about the understanding, it's more about philosophical understanding of the behavior.
What can you get below 2?
No, that's an open problem. So nobody knows. For instance, a natural thing to do, which I wanted to mention only at the end, was if you take Euclid's algorithm, it's known how to push down, to transform Euclid's algorithm into a quasi-linear algorithm. But for lattice reduction, it's unknown. For this reduction, we don't know how to do it. So that would be the natural step now.
Did you have to sacrifice A when you push 3 down to 2?
No, you also decrease A in process. So, I mean, if you think about what would be the natural thing, maybe it would be an exponent of 3, but nobody knows how to get 3. Right now it's 5. Here. So what is interesting also is that in our analysis, we just took the worst case bound. So when you do the worst case analysis, we are limited by construction by Hermite's constant in dimension 2. That's why in all these approximation factors, you have a 4/3. So it's coming from Hermite's constant in dimension 2. Since the invention of LLL, many people have reported that LLL behaves better than expected. But how better in practice? Well, it turns out it seems that in practice, so I'm just saying it seems because of course I don't have any proof of that. It just seems that in practice it's not exactly true. But what seems to happen in practice is that the exponential behavior remains. You still have an exponential approximation factor. But in practice, this constant seems to be replaced by a much smaller constant. And the thing is, when you have an exponential, so maybe what happens in practice in the 80s is if you have an exponent, the constant is very close to 1, you don't really see the exponential behavior until you hit very high dimensions. So because the constant was very close to 1, it seems that in practice, when you take a very small, when you take low dimensional lattices, you don't see this exponential behavior. So that's why people thought that it behaves like an oracle, but it's not exactly true. What would be very interesting is to guess the value of this constant. So it seems what is really surprising that whatever lattice you plug into LLL, it's always the same constant here, empirically. So that's very strange. And I don't know any good explanation about what is the value of this constant. You can observe it empirically, but why should it be that constant? It's not surprising that you have a smaller constant, because finding 4-fold all the time would be like asking that every two-dimensional inside a lattice is a critical lattice, which would be very unfortunate. So it's not surprising that it's a smaller constant, but why should it be almost independent of the lattice? I have no idea. So it would be very interesting if someone could find an explanation for that. Well, at least guess the value. Why should be, is it, does it have any natural value? I have no idea. So what happens if we want to improve the algorithms? So we saw that LLL is essentially Hermite's inequality. So what happens, we know in mathematics better ways of bounding Hermite's constants. Well, if you look at classical books on geometry of numbers, there's a very there's a generalization of Hermite's inequality, which is known as Mordell's inequality. So Mordell's inequality is just this. So if you take k equal to 2, then you get Hermite's inequality. How do you prove this? Well, if you look at this inequality, it suffices to prove this inequality for k equal to d minus 1. Once you prove it for k equal to d minus 1, you just use it several times and you get this inequality. And the reason, the way you prove it for k equal to d minus 1 is you just use a primal dual transfer. Now, what is interesting is that this inequality is actually tight for two values at least, for 3, 4, and 7, 8. So, for instance, if you know Hermite's constant in dimension 3, you also know actually Hermite's constant in dimension 4. And the same, if you know it, Hermite's constant in dimension 7, you actually know Hermite's constant in dimension 8. Thanks to this tight, this bound becomes tight for these dimensions. So, why it's interesting here is that if you view Hermite's inequality, it certainly tells you that if you can solve the shortest vector problem in dimension 2, then you can approximate the shortest vector problem in higher dimension. So if you want to interpret this, you should say, what happens if I have an oracle that solves me, that solves my shortest vector problem in small dimension k? Can I use this to approximate the shortest vector in much higher dimension using that oracle? So the proof is not complicated here, but I'm not going to do it. However, it's not as trivial, I mean, before, when we took Hermite's inequality, it was trivial to transform it into a lattice algorithm. Transforming this inequality to an algorithm, you have to be very careful. It's not obvious. So this is what we want. We would like some algorithmic equivalent of this inequality. We'd like something to say, I give you an oracle which solves the shortest vector problem in dimension k. Can I use that oracle to find in polynomial times, so I mean using a polynomial number of calls to the oracle and polynomial number of operations. But I want the same approximation factor than for models inequality. So something which, compared to a Hermite's inequality, so you still have an exponential behavior, but the constant inside the exponential grows converges to 1. So you have something k to the power 1 over k. So that would be the natural question when you see, I mean, do I want an algorithmic equivalent of Mordell's inequality? That's what I want. So the first improvement to LLL was found by Schnorr in 1987, and that's what, so this is just a summary of the results. I'm just going to ignore all the details. Suppose you have an oracle which solves the shortest vector problem up to, say, dimension 2 times k. Schnorr algorithm finds you in polynomial time the non-zero lattice vector of norm this. So the initial, so this bound is a bit slightly better than the original bound found by Schnorr, as you can find in that crypto 2006. But if you look at this bound, you realize that it's not exactly what I wanted for Mordell's inequality, because I only wanted an oracle up to dimension k with a quality k now over 1 over 2 k. Because I I switch from quadratic forms to lattices, so I have to lose the 2 here. So here you have a log 2, so this log 2 is annoying. It's not exactly, it's still asymptotically the same, but it's not exactly what I want for models inequality. And also, when you find this bound, then now it's natural to see why you have a function of roughly the shape k over 1 over k. It's because of models inequality. You cannot really improve them over it. So what is interesting that, like, so a few years ago, Koe found something which we call transference reduction, which was only published this year, which is given an oracle which solves SVP to dimension k plus 1, it finds you exactly what you want, that is a non-zero lattice vector of norm given by Mordor's inequality. Except that it's k plus 1 and not k. But still, now it's much closer to Mordor's inequality in terms of algorithms. Still, it's not the perfect equivalent, but still, it's much, it gives you a better analog. So that's quite interesting. So now I want to describe how it works.
So what does K stand for?
K stands for a block size which
can
improve.
No, it's
Koi. Koi. So a student of former student of Splash Hall. So the idea is, like, if you look at LL, so once you transform your basis into a triangular basis, the only thing that LL is doing is working on the small 2x2 squares, close to the diagonal, and reduce, in the sense of Lagrange, all those squares iteratively. So we do some kind of strings. I don't want to enter into detail, but really the main idea is just this. Make sure that all those 2x2 lattices are reduced. What you do in block reduction, you just consider a bigger size. So you're going to take, for any k, you're going to consider 2k dimensional lattices. So here I take a picture where k is equal to 2. So I have to consider 4x4 blocks. So I do this, I do this, I do this. And what is interesting is that you have an intersection here. This is in common between the two consecutive lattices. And here we have an intersection hole. So here, this is an intersection. The question is, what kind of reduction are we going to use? Because in LL, there's only one canonical notion of reduction in dimension 2. But what happens when you take bigger blocks? It's not clear what kind of reduction inside a block would be the optimal one. So essentially, block reduction is really the same, using the same idea as LL, just using more technical details. So it turns out that the reader, if you really want to have the best notion of reduction adapted to this strategy, you have to consider this problem, which is a generalization of the shortest vector problem, which we call the smallest volume problem. The problem is as follows. Suppose you have also an integer k, less than the dimension, and again you have a basis of the lattice. Now, instead of finding a shortest vector, you want to find a basis of the lattice which minimizes the volume of the first k vectors. So if k is equal to 1, the volume is just the norm. So it's just the same thing as the shortest vector problem. But when k equal to 2, you already have a different problem. So the shortest vector problem is really the algorithmic analog of Hermite's constant. This problem is actually the analog of something known as Rankine's constant. Rankine's constant is the following. You take a lattice, and you consider all the k vectors which are linearly independent in the lattice, and you ask for the minimal value of the volume, homogenized by the volume here. And then you all again take the maximum value of this over all d-dimensional lattices. So what do we know about Rankine's constant, which was introduced about 50 years ago? So first of all, if you take, so this is the definition of the constant. If you take gamma d1, you come back to Hermite's constant, obviously. And you have some duality relation, which is gamma dk is equal to gamma d minus k, just by using transference. And now Mordor's inequality is just a particular case of a general inequality on all the Rankine's constant, which is the following. Well, value doesn't really matter, but it's just about, if you think about the terms about what is the algorithmic equivalent of this inequality or not, that's really what we're interested in. So you may wonder, before I ask for basis, and here I only ask for linearly independent vectors, it doesn't matter. It's the same value if you take linearly independent or fixed vectors which can be extended to a basis, exactly the same value for this minimum. And now we have the right notion. Now if we ask what do we do inside each 2K block, well, ideally we just would like to solve the smallest volume problem. So we'd like to find a basis in this lattice of dimension 2K such that the volume of the first K vectors is minimal. Ideally, that would be the best way of extending LLL to blocks. So the relation of the Lagrange reduction in dimension 2 to a 2K block would be the smallest volume problem. Unfortunately, we do not know how to solve the smallest volume problem in fixed dimension with a good running time. Whereas for the shortest vector problem, we know how to do it quite efficiently for small dimension. As a result, in both Schnorr algorithms or in transference reduction, we only use an approximation of that problem. So something we can prove guarantees. I mean, it's not just an approximation, a heuristic approximation. You can find some provable guarantees. Otherwise, you will not have a provable algorithm in the end. So what happens for the limit? So if you think about this strategy, because Moore's inequality can be tight in certain cases, it sounds very difficult to imagine that this Brock strategy could be improved. I mean, we cannot hope to find a vector for which a dependency, the quality of the length, would be better than Moore's inequality. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that. And the problem we have with both LLL and Schnorr algorithm and on transference reduction is that the algorithm doesn't just give you an approximation of the shortest vector, something of this shape. It also gives you this thing. So as a result, it also comes up with an implicit upper bound on Hermite's constant. So whenever you have an algorithm like this, you know it must correspond to a way of bounding Hermite's constant in mathematics. But the problem is that if you look at the mathematical literature, there's not that many methods known to bound Hermite's constant. So in retrospect, I don't think it's surprising that there are so few algorithms, because from the beginning, we don't have that many methods to bound Hermite's constant, without even thinking about efficiency, just thinking about what we're doing. So is that the end? Well, fortunately, there's another way, there's another kind of less traditional algorithm, both which only come with this thing, not with this. So then maybe we can free ourselves from bounding Hermite's constant. So what algorithms do we know? There's only essentially two algorithms right now in terms of provable algorithms. The first one is the one found by Cannon right after LLL, because it's a direct application of LLL. So the deterministic algorithm, which has super exponential time, so it's something about this shape. But the good thing is it has negligible space. And this algorithm, so even for its super exponential, it's really used in practice for, say, d less than 30. And the reason is because you have the same thing as for LLL. In LLL, I told you that the constants are actually smaller in practice. So here, even though you have a super exponential time, if the constant is very close to 1, it's still doable in practice. On the other hand, there's another algorithm found by Itai, Kumar, and Sivak Kumar in 2001, which is this time randomized. It only has exponential time, but the problem is that it also has exponential space. So right now, I don't know anyone who implemented this algorithm who managed to do something better than this one. So right now, this algorithm is not used in practice. But maybe it's possible to use the ideas and improve it to something practical. Well, I know that Schnorr has been working on this. So you could say maybe this is much better than this, but it really depends on the value of the constants. And it also depends on the space requirements. It's really tricky. I'm just going to say how the algorithms work. So Cannon's algorithm is really a straightforward application of LLL, or any reduction notion you can find in reasonable time, what you do is you just compute a reduced basis. If you imagine if your basis was orthogonal, the shortest vector would just be one of your basis vectors, because you just decompose your vectors over that basis, and then obviously the shortest vector must be one of your initial vectors. If your basis is only close to being orthogonal, that means that any short vector must have small coefficients. So if they're very small, you can do some exhaustive search. So that's essentially Kanaan's algorithm. You just find the coefficients of the shortest vector with respect to that reduced basis using exhaustive search. And then you get this, if you do the things correctly, you get this super exponential running time. AKS works quite differently. What you do is you do the following. You generate an exponential number of random points inside a hyperbole. So you take the uniform distribution inside a hyperbole. How do you select your hyperbole? It's just going to be a center at zero. And you're going to choose a radius which is roughly close to the first minimum. After that, then you're going to use your initial reduced basis, which is not that good, to approximate those points to lattice vectors. So you're going to find plenty of lattice vectors which are close to those random points. And then you're going to eject some of those points, but you're going to keep most of them. But what you're going to do is you're going to be able to refine these approximations to find better and better lattice vectors close to those lattice points using a sieving technique. And at the end, if you do things correctly, the first minimum of your lattice should appear as a subtraction of approximations. So you really see where the exponential space is coming from. You have to keep this exponential number of random points. You lose some of them by sieving, but still you keep an exponential number of points. And at the end, you have to subtract all those approximations. So that's essentially the AKS algorithm. So now we survey the main algorithms, so there's a lot of open problems. Obviously, the first open problem would be trying to find new lattice reduction algorithms, because there are so few of them. Let me first speculate about what's going on. So the problem we have is right now we have extremely few algorithms, and you have very elementary techniques. I mean, the algorithms are nice, but in terms of tools, they don't use a sophisticated technique like, say, the number field sieve. So when you have that, then there's two questions. Either we haven't looked hard enough, or it's really a difficult problem. So of course you could say, well, from complexity theory, we know it's a hard problem. But still, it doesn't prevent anything in terms of approximation algorithms. Right now, a lot of things could maybe still be possible. So what kind of direction could we see to improve our algorithms or find new algorithms? Well, obviously, if I had the answer to that question, I would do it myself. So I don't have the answer to that question. I'm just going to speculate. So when you really look at the NLL and Schnorr algorithm, they do use duality, but we don't use it very much. So maybe there's a way to better exploit duality in algorithms. Why would we think about duality? It's because if you look up, there's a lot of literature in the complexity papers about lattices, and one of the trends is to use transference theorems, to use primal dual connections. So maybe there's a better way of doing this for algorithms and not proving complexity results. Another curious thing is to try to exploit distributions, like in the AKS algorithm or recent work by Schnorr. When you think about Kanaan's algorithm, for instance, you just do an exhaustive search, just computing the norms. But you don't do any experiments on your small lattice. Maybe by doing something better, using some random experiments, and analyzing the result of your random experiment, you could conclude better things on your lattices. So that's one potential way. There's a lot of open problems, and this is just my personal selection. So at Dangerstein notice, it's well known that for Euclid's algorithm, you can improve it to obtain quasi-linear running time. So the obvious question now that approximate Hermit reduction can be achieved in quadratic time without fast multiplication technique, is it possible to obtain quasi-linear running time, so something of the shape d2 power something log b, log log b, say. So that would be interesting, but it sounds very difficult, you know? A very open question is, are there some special lattices for which they have better algorithms? So of course, the general problem is hard, but maybe it's possible to exploit the structure of certain lattices to obtain better algorithms. So there's just been a preliminary study of symplectic lattices, like Henschel lattices. So that's at EuroCube 2006, but right now it's still open. We don't know. LLL can be improved here, but it's not clear whether the improved version of LLL, a general algorithm, can also be made much faster for symplectic lattices. In Daniel's talk on Friday, of course, there's the natural case of cyclic lattices. Is it possible to obtain better algorithms for cyclic lattices? A very interesting open problem is the understanding the average case of lattice reduction. So in the past few years, there's been a lot of papers by Itai on random lattices, which are very interesting. So there's actually a natural notion of random lattices. You can really pick, there's a natural distribution of lattices. And the question is, can we understand what happens when you take a random lattice and you apply your algorithm? Can you prove something on the behavior? Or what can you say in practice on lattice reduction in practice? That is, we know these worst case bounds, we know these experimental bounds, can we explain the difference? And of course, the most famous open problem regarding lattice reduction is it possible to find a polynomial time algorithms that approximate the shortest vector problem within a polynomial factor? So this, according to complexity result, is maybe possible. Maybe it's not, but it's not. Right now, it doesn't contradict the complexity results, the Hermite results. However, so if you think about this, and you think about Hermite's inequality, Hermite's constants, you could think that maybe such an algorithm should come up with a polynomial bound on Hermite's constants. And right now, the only bound I know which is polynomial for Hermite's constant is the one following by Minkowski's theorem. It's not clear at all why Minkowski's theorem could be transformed algorithmically into a polynomial time algorithm. But I mean, that's just one way of seeing it. Maybe it's just very narrow. So thank you for your attention.